Our reading this morning is a little bit of an experiment. It's a reading from a lecture that was given by Alan Watts in California in the mid-60s. I think in this part of the reading he refers to some of the listeners to that reading as cats. So that's how you'll know it's not a completely contemporary reading. And I thought, well, if we're going to share the words of Alan Watts, who better to read Alan Watts than Alan Watts himself? So we'll play a recording this morning. He spent a good part of his life speaking in front of groups and is pretty good at it. He speaks slowly and evenly, but you will have to listen with an accent because he has a British accent. And the few of you who are here who are British yourselves will have a chance to stop listening in an accent to all of our American accents and just listen in British for a few minutes. Because the acoustics in this room shift as people come and go, depending on how full the room is, we don't know for sure if the sound is right where it needs to be. So if you can't hear this clearly, just raise your hand, and Mary will turn it up a little bit in the back. And if you can hear it just fine, well, just listen to Alan Watts.
That is the reason why. This is the real reason why. Zen cannot be explained. You have to make, as it were, a jump from the valuation game of better people and worse people, in groups and out groups. And you can only make it by seeing that they all are mutually interdependent. So if we take this situation, let's say I would be talking to you and saying, look, I have some very special thing that you've got to take notice of. Therefore, I am the in-group, and I'm the teacher, and you are the out-group. I know perfectly well that I cannot be the teacher unless you come here. And so that my status and my position is totally dependent on you. It isn't something you see, therefore I have first, and then you get. These things arise mutually. So if you wouldn't come, I wouldn't talk. I wouldn't know what to say. Because I borrowed your language. So that is the insight that things go together. Then, when you see that and aren't in competition, then you don't make a mistake. Because you don't dither. When I first learned the piano and played these wretched scales, the teacher beside me had a pencil in her hand and she hit my fingers every time I made a wrong note. Consequent was I never learned to read music because I hesitated too long to play the note on time. Because I was always, is this pencil going to land? See? And that gets built into your psyche. And so people are always, although they're adults and nobody is clubbing them around and screaming at them any longer, they hear the echoes of that screaming mama or that dominating papa in the back of their heads all their life long. And so they adopt the same attitudes to their own children, and the farce continues. Because there is no, I mean, I don't say that you shouldn't lay down the law to children if you want them to play the social game. But if you lay down the law to your children, you must make provision later in life for them to be liberated. To go through a process of curing them from the bad effects of education. But you can't do that unless you too grow up, you see? Unless we grow up. Says I, including myself.
Unitarian Universalists have our seven principles, which articulate the way we want to live in the world. They are our covenant with the world. And I find that we have to dig into the sources of our tradition to find the tools to live into the covenant. If you open the hymnals to the second or third page, I think, you'll find the seven principles. And then under them, you'll find the sources. I think you have to get past the table of contents. It's more than 3 pages. Under those 7 principles, which we are most familiar with, are a list of sources that we draw from. And I think that it is in those sources that we find the ways to help ourselves live into the fairly lofty principles. Some of those sources are the words and deeds of prophetic men and women, and the wisdom of world religions, which inspire us to our ethical and spiritual life. And that's why today, for instance, we turn to the wisdom of Buddhism through the incisive mind of Alan Watts. Has anyone in this room ever been in the presence of Alan Watts? Someone in our congregation has been, but Alan Watts died in 1973, I think, so it's been a while. He trained as an Episcopal priest, and then I think not long after he was ordained, decided that he wasn't Episcopalian at all, and he came to the States, first to New York City and then to California, where he didn't ever become a Buddhist monk, but trained in Buddhism and learned about Buddhism and Hinduism and Taoism, all of the traditions from Eastern culture, and brought those to our culture. He was really interested in freeing the mind, which is how all of those traditions talk about the work that we have to do with our own minds. And he, I think, has really shaped how we hear Buddhism and Hinduism and even yoga to some extent, because he mixed those religious traditions with the Western ideas of psychology and even ecology. So most of us hear Buddhism with that slant today, and there's a certain self-conscious psychological work about it. And I don't know if Buddhism in China and Japan and Tibet has that in it. I think it's less self-conscious. But we'll probably never know, because we're in this world. But those traditions have a strong, systematic way of dealing with our unconscious minds so that we can be clear and present in our daily lives and free or more free from the fears and confusions that swirl through our minds most of the time and make it hard to live into those highest principles that we know are the way we want to live. They're just hard to get to. So in spiritual community, we learn and use tools for training our minds. That piece of audio that I played for you is rich enough that we could talk about it for an hour, which I won't do. But it's useful to know that there's enough there that if you feel like you didn't catch all of it, it's not you. As I listened to that story, I remembered a man that I knew in San Francisco who had studied Zen and had sat in Zazen, which is to say, sat on a meditation cushion for 2 half-hour sessions every day for years. He was eccentric in a very understated way. He was warm and engaging and had worked as a lawyer for decades. All of that seemed normal enough. But I remember being at the coffee hour at the church, the Unitarian Church in San Francisco, and talking to him about the weather or the children or something, and he would be nodding and listening, and then he would say, "Do you ever just wonder what we're standing on?" Well, sometimes I do, I thought, but I'm not prepared for that question at this moment, and I have no idea how to respond to it. And I usually sort of just looked confused and stuttered something, but he would look just as interested in my stuttering, and he would keep nodding and listening as if I was just as insightful when I was flustered as I had been when I was composed and articulate. I knew that he was very interested in Zen and that this way of being was from Zen, but I didn't really understand what was happening at the time because I was busy being flustered. And he was really being Zen with me, by which I mean he was teaching me the principles that Alan Watts was talking about by being them rather than talking about them. He was not worried about looking foolish for asking some huge, bizarre question out of the blue. And he was not worried about making me uncomfortable or confused because he had said or asked something that was unusual. And then he hung in there with me, so I was never flustered alone. I was flustered, but he stayed there. So he was also showing me the principle that Alan Watts talks about, that we humans are so concerned about doing the right thing most of the time. We don't even notice how much of our thinking every moment is about whether what we're doing is appropriate or acceptable, or whether we might be hurting someone's feelings, or whether we might be looking weird right now, or whether what we've said is responsible enough or too responsible, or not productive enough, or you know the narrative. This Zen master who I don't think he was a master, but this Zen man who I talked with at coffee hours in San Francisco surely wrestled with that himself, but he had also gotten back to that childlike state in which he would just pop out with an existential question while eating carrots in the middle of the day, and it was fine. So he also lived in the idea of being mutually interdependent. He was at least 40 years older than I was. He was an accomplished lawyer. He had many years of Zen practice. I found him slightly intimidating. I was just 2 years out of college, no years in Zen training, working 2 part-time jobs, riding the bus everywhere. He acted as if these descriptors were unimportant. He was there, I was there, we could have an exchange. If I wasn't there, there was no conversation to have. And it was the exchange that was of interest to him. He was interested in seeing another mind at work and seeing how his mind worked in the presence of someone else's thinking. He was interested to see how I understood things, what meaning I gave to things that he had made assumptions about or that had puzzled him. You have probably known someone who was that openly curious, and it's delightful to have a conversation with them, if a little flustering. I am living with a Zen master currently, as is your family. The Burns are in the front row here. Having a baby in your household is a little like having a Zen master visit for a while. They have that quality of being completely curious about how the meetings will happen. One of the ways that we've noticed this most recently in our house is that we've taught Ronan a little bit of sign language. He can sign milk and more and all done. He hardly ever signs all done. But he does sign more, a lot. We've given him these words mostly for meal times. We thought it would be useful for him to be able to tell us that he wants more, that he's done. But he never uses them at mealtime. He uses them at other times mostly. We gave him something with one intention, and he has gone off and used it for something else entirely, which is fascinating to me. The other morning, he woke up and he rolled around in bed and he looked at me and signed, "More what?" We've just gotten started. And we were driving somewhere recently, and he sat in his car seat in the back there. More what? He signs this just all the time now, and it seems to me that he doesn't mean anything concrete. It means yes, it means I like this, it means some kind of existential enthusiasm for life. Can a not quite year old person have existential enthusiasm for life? I'm not sure, but he has clearly taken in some information from us and worked it around in his own mind and made it into something else. He's not just repeating what we've done. He's doing his own thing and communicating back to us, even though we don't really know what's happening. And I am struck by his response to this language that we've given him, partially because he is not worried about doing it wrong. I know quite a bit of Spanish, but I hardly ever speak it. I'm afraid that I will say it wrong, that someone will not understand what I am trying to say to them, or that someone will feel weird because I'm speaking Spanish and they don't know what I'm saying. Ronan is not the least bit concerned about those things. It has not crossed his mind that one could worry about those things. He's using his words in a way that is clear to him. And the idea of using it wrong or making a mistake has not entered his world. And that is part of what is so joyful about being with him. He just tries out what he has. He does sometimes literally fall on his face, but it doesn't deter him at all. His drive for more is stronger than any confusion or resistance. Alan Watts says that making a mistake and not making a mistake are the same thing. That both are moments when we are being ourselves. That the only mistake we can make is to try to pretend to be someone else instead of being ourselves. Being ourselves with the hiccups and the selfishness and the confusion and the glories and all of it. What we think of as a mistake is either us just being exactly how we are in this moment, or an opportunity to see the world in a fresh way. That's all. I'm tempted to say that Alan Watts isn't talking about the ordinary mistakes that we make. Leaving our calendars at home on a busy day, putting the wrong zip code on an envelope, dialing the wrong number, but I think he does mean those too. He would say, well, you do have to get certain numbers on an envelope to get the letter to arrive, but there is no moral weight to having the right numbers or some other numbers on an envelope. The only thing it really tells us is how our minds are working, if they are distracted or present. And there is no moral weight to that either. So, of course, I got thinking, well, I think you could make some mistakes that would have moral weight. If you ran over someone in your car because your mind was not in the present, or because you were on a phone call or deeply preoccupied with the past, well, that would have moral weight. And the Buddhists explain that in the same way that Unitarian Universalists do. They have an eightfold path, just as we have seven principles. And in the eightfold path, they talk about right action and right speech. And those include doing no harm to living beings. There will have to be another sermon about what it means to do no harm. Suffice it to say that we could stand to make considerably more mistakes in our lives and still do no harm. And if that was our practice, we would likely find that it felt scary to make mistakes and that it was just an interesting episode, a chance to see how our minds work with other minds, which is what we did last weekend at the Leap of Faith event. We thought and we wondered and we questioned and we practiced being mutually interdependent. Some of what we heard from our mentor congregation could only be said because we were here listening and engaged. They would not have said some of what they did if we weren't interested. And some of the joy that they felt from us only came because we remembered that we are not working on this project of church life alone. The conversation itself called something into being that is not there when two thinking groups don't meet. When we visited the mentor congregation a few months ago, we came away with the sense that having high expectations was important. And I spent the intervening time between that visit in October, I think, and their visit here thinking that that meant not making any mistakes. So I was glad to run into Alan Watts recently so that he could remind me that making mistakes is part of the process of creation. And our visiting congregation last week said, well, high expectations, but hold it lightly. And that's where the work is, isn't it? To have high expectations and hold it lightly. To have high expectations and be willing to make mistakes in order to approach those high expectations. So I've been thinking, if I am going to lead you in this leap of faith, or leaping the fence, as someone put it, I'll have to do two things, at least, a little differently. One is to share my visions and hopes for church and for life a little more directly and a little more often. And the other is to make mistakes in public. You, of course, have seen me doing that all along. It's different to make them knowing that they're a chance for us to have a conversation and a meeting, that that's the gift of the mistakes. So as I talk about my vision for the world and for this congregation and for Unitarian Universalism, you may love what I say, and you may not love what I say. And it turns out that the point isn't whether we agree exactly, but whether we have a real conversation about real hopes and passions and possibilities. I think I have done the thing that many a minister has done, which is to try to avoid upsetting people by not talking about the deepest visions and hopes. I talk about part of it, but not the fullness of it. Meanwhile, people get a little frustrated with a partial plan. It's a sure sign that it's time to play the notes on the piano, not hesitate as Alan Watts learned to do with that rapping pencil on his knuckles. You may not like some of the notes that get played, but if they've been played wholeheartedly, then each of us can have an exchange. And even if we don't agree, we can understand each other more deeply, which is what it's all about. And in this way, none of us can make a mistake. We can only learn together about how to engage our lives with more purpose and more spiritual depth.